There are a lot more people that are trying to rattle the cages for change.
Are you interested in improving transportation systems? What do you think about urban retrofitting for better urban mobility? How can we judge urban transformation that requires behavior change? Stay tuned for answers from Oliver Stolz.
What is the future for cities?
Do you want to learn more about them?
Do you want to know how others think about them?
Do you want to be part of the conversation?
Then this is the right place.
Welcome to What is the Future for Cities podcast. Today, I will interview Oliver Stolz, a strategic transport planner. We will talk about his vision for the future of cities, false positives and real positives, urban mobility services, benefits of big events for the infrastructure, and many more. So let's start with a proper introduction. Oliver is a strategic transport planner with a broad range of experience across growth, inner city, and regional local government areas. He is on the front line of trying to lead behavior change through strategy to support infrastructure changes for the population of tomorrow in order to support active and public transport as the preferred mode of transport by the masses. Additionally, he has experience in the major event space, working in transport planning for multi-sport events both here in Australia and abroad. And with that, Oliver, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for your time on the podcast. I highly appreciate your appearance. Let's jump right in. What does the future of cities mean to you?
The future of cities means to me change. We need to see a change of direction, whether that's around housing and transport, probably tied in together. With the way that history's evolved and our population's evolved at the same time, I think that a different city based on perhaps some of the old world principles, something that we need to head a little bit more towards, living closer to one another, getting to places in different means of transport, certainly steering away from private vehicles that are cars for the most part.
So the changes are around staying closer to home and encouraging people to use their private cars less.
I think the major changes would be changes of infrastructure in order to accommodate better active travel, whether that's walking, riding, or something else that evolves over time. And then an increased uplift in service around public transport to enable, encourage, and prevent people from using their vehicle as much as possible, their private cars.
That was a very interesting choice of word, saying preventing people to use their individual vehicles. Can we prevent people to do that?
In today's society, 100% no, we definitely can't. The follow-up question to your question may be, what's the definition of future? The further we get down the path, the more we can evolve those things. I think in an ideal world, from a strategic transport approach, we probably would be looking at ways to discourage private vehicle use. But in the short term, we need to be thinking about it more from an encouragement approach. So if we've got the infrastructure there, we've got the services there, then people can see the difference before that slowly evolves to a point where we can start discouraging, putting more taxes on, more tolls on. And hopefully along the way, some people are getting to that point themselves. But I think the reality is that the nasty world of taxes and tolls at some stage in the distant future, be that 20 years or 70, 80 years, we're going to have to come to the forefront.
So you are more on the side that in the near future, it will be more carrots and then the sticks will be slowly and gradually introduced?
Absolutely. As much as I'm a huge advocate for getting people onto the buses and trains, if they're not there, you can't get rid of the cars first and start taxing and tolling people and telling them to get there on a bus or a train when it doesn't exist. I think once a service is in place and it's effective and efficient, then that's when we can start looking down that space. As much as I consider myself anti-car, I think there's probably a realistic approach that a lot of the world needs a car. A lot of the world could use their car a lot less, but a lot of the world definitely needs a car for their day-to-day uses. I guess my approach at the moment may be that they might be able to shave 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% of that use off in our current world. But the reality is that some of the time they do need a private vehicle.
Your approach is not about the combustion engine vehicle. Your approach is about all of the individual vehicles.
All of the individual private motor vehicles. Yeah. So if we're looking at electric engines, my approach is that there's still a car on the network. You can still get hit by a car that's electric and it will still hurt a lot if it's going over a certain speed. It still costs a lot of money to build that vehicle. It still uses a lot of resources to build that vehicle. But as much as I like to think of a byproduct of what I'm doing as being a greener, healthier future, I think the majority of my work probably is more focused around the actual movement of people. So it would be wonderful if we could all live in a greener transport network, but that's not the primary motivation for getting people out of their cars. I think it's more just about how we can use our space better so that it's more inviting on lots of fronts. Like obviously if we're removing as many vehicle movements from local streets and slowing those movements down, the ones that do remain, then it becomes more of the old play streets that our parents spoke about or we had as kids when we were much younger. And sadly, that world has disappeared a little bit. And I think a lot of that does come around having bigger cars, faster cars, more cars. That space is under a lot more pressure than it was even 20, 30 years ago. And it's only going to get under a lot more if we keep moving at the same pace that we are.
The transportation is the movement of people and not those vehicles. That's really interesting. And I would be a bit cheeky because it's very surprising from a person from your background, very much involved with urban mobility, because in the last 100 years, one could argue that we have been planning cities around how the cars move. And I would assume that a transport engineer, a transport planner would be very happy about that, but I might be wrong. Am I wrong?
Australia's definitely been planning our cities around the car. We plan our suburbs around cars. While I am a transport planner, I'm not a transport engineer. And in the workplace there too, we don't necessarily always walk hand in hand. So there's certainly disagreements that healthy disagreements that an engineer and transport planner would have. I think traditionally over previous decades, a transport planner or an urban planner has had a very different view on the world. And while we can look through history and see some great examples of planners that when we go to university, we hear about, I think sadly, there's probably a little bit more in line with let's move that car in the safest way, fastest way possible. But the safety's been orientated around the driver. And yeah, the world is built around the car. The car is built around the person. It's not built around who's on the outside. So I'm very much of the opinion that when it comes to engineering, the safety aspect is of the utmost importance. However, the utmost importance is the safety of those around the car, not the other way around. And I think the byproduct of that would be the reality is the cars are moving slower and making different turn patterns and different movements so that the driver themselves is only going to be much, much safer than they currently are anyway.
Could you please explain what's the difference between a transport engineer and a transport planner?
Well, a transport planner would come more from an urban planning background, so looking at the strategy of transport, whereas transport engineer is probably looking at it more from a fine grain modelling approach where it comes to the layout of a traffic intersection, be that signalised or not, the width of roads, the gradient of roads, everything that's associated with that when it comes to curbs and the surfacing on the road. Yeah, so it's a very different approach about the network in making sure that we're providing a certain level of service for the vehicle. And I think that's probably an issue that we've seen a lot in growth areas around Melbourne, in that while it's great to look at this network here is going to be able to function at a certain level, the functioning at a certain level is based around the car. So having reduced lag times at intersections, reduced journey times along a network, when that's the measurement of success, whereas sometimes some of those levers could actually work in the favour of public transport and active transport, because if those roads aren't functioning at the old world level, then perhaps people will consider using the other modes of transport sooner than if that network is always going at a particular level of service, which is definitely something that in Australia we have looked to follow.
You described how the network of the transportation could work and probably should work. Would autonomous vehicles help with these network connections?
Short answer, yes. Long answer, I think it's a lot more complicated than that. So I think when it comes to autonomous vehicles, we're probably still walking a little bit into the unknown. So while it would be wonderful to have our streets replaced with autonomous vehicles, it may improve things like on-street parking, which might mean that our streets could be safer for bikes and for pedestrians. We could have our streets a little bit narrower. when we're rebuilding them, obviously when that comes at a cost as well. In a freeway capacity, perhaps it would be really efficient. I'm not sure if on a local road capacity that having a whole run of autonomous vehicles would necessarily make a extremely efficient network, because I suspect that it would only encourage more vehicles to be there and they might be running in a beautiful pattern. But when it comes down to bikes and pedestrians, they're the great unknowns, aren't they? And then as soon as you throw in weather or sunset or some weird event that changes how those vehicles go, I think we're too early on in the piece. And probably a little bit similar to how I view electric vehicles is, while there's probably some great things that come with autonomous vehicles, and I'm certainly not going to discourage that sort of evolution, I'm just not sure it's the answer to all our problems. It may be a great answer to things like freight movements, which is wonderful. We need to, I'd be the first to admit that if I had the magic power to put tolls on a freeway, I think I wouldn't be tolling the freight. I wouldn't be tolling the supermarket trucks that go through, because we need those vehicles to move. I would be tolling the mum and dad that are sitting in a car by themselves, because why are they driving on that freeway? Like, if we're putting the infrastructure to encourage them elsewhere, I don't think it's the essential movements, which is of our goods, that should be tolled in order to accommodate their movements. And in a similar vein, I'd probably also expand that out to tradespeople, for example, as well. Like, if you're driving around, not everyone needs to drive a truck, but the people that do need to drive a truck tend to be tradespeople. And so I don't think they should be punished for getting to work with the tools that they need to get there with. But at the same time, if I'm going to my job in the CBD, why on earth would I be driving there? If I choose to do it, great, it's a free world. Perhaps I should pay the price.
Very interesting to hear how you think about the service level of the roads and what kind of services they provide. And those could be great opportunities, but let's first discuss what are the three biggest fears or concerns regarding the future of cities for you.
Look, I think my three biggest concerns are that we don't adapt to the change around pedestrian movements, which couples with something I've touched on earlier, is that we're definitely becoming a society of much bigger vehicles in Australia. So the vehicles that we're driving around in are exploding in size. The bonnet of a car is much higher. If you get hit by a car these days, you're more likely to go under the car instead of onto the bonnet. As much as I don't want to end up on the bonnet of a car, I'd rather be on the bonnet of a car than underneath one, because the chances of dying are much higher. And so if we're having cars hit us at a low speed, but they're driving a big Mack truck when they don't need to, that's where we're going to see increased pedestrian deaths, which we're seeing around the world. And so I think my concern would be that we've continued to get into bigger and bigger cars, and that we haven't changed our infrastructure in order to support pedestrians. I know that from local sense around where I live, while there may be a reasonably good level of pedestrian crossings when it comes to roundabout treatments, my counter argument would that be is that every side street is a car feels like it has priority when it takes the turn at speed, that the raised crossings are perhaps sometimes viewed as an optional traffic management, which of course they're not. It is there for the pedestrians to walk across a zebra crossing when there's yellow lights. But pedestrian safety needs to be paramount, and we need to prioritise pedestrians. If we start at our most vulnerable users, then we can accommodate everyone else along the way. So that would be my biggest fear, that we don't embrace the basic logic of what we know makes our society work in a better space. Bike infrastructure, I think we're seeing some really good dominoes falling in this space. I'm viewing this as a glass half full optimist approach, aware that particularly through the 90s and the early 2000s in Victoria, we just didn't see any bike infrastructure going in. The bike infrastructure may have been associated with a recreational use, so along a creek bed or along a river, which now may be becoming more useful from a network perspective. But in terms of putting protected bike lanes in, we just didn't see that for the most part. In fact, I can't really think of many that are existing that I would think are any more than 10 years old for the most part, whereas we are seeing some change in that space. And I think St Kilda Road in Melbourne recently has put down some impressive infrastructure. People love jumping on and telling everything that's wrong with it, but the reality is that I don't know a retrofit project that's ever won the hearts and minds of 100% of the people. And I, for one, think that the infrastructure that's gone in down St Kilda Road is great. And I think that will allow the councils that are joined there, which would be Melbourne, Stonington and City of Port Phillip, to then leverage off that piece of infrastructure. So the state infrastructure that's gone in, I think that is a statement piece, and I think it allows the councils to then leverage off that. Again, it probably does go back to my concern is that if perhaps the younger generation is following in the footsteps of the ones before them, in that a lot of the older generation in wealthier areas of Melbourne or just in general tend to not like change. And the idea of putting in bike infrastructure is something that they're not incredibly supportive of. So I would hope that moving forward, we're going to see a more supportive older bracket, be that 10, 20, 30 years. I think I'd be really disappointed if we just followed the same mistake and didn't make the most of the opportunities that we've got ahead of us when it comes to bike riding. I think bike riding is a pretty simple argument in that if we provide the infrastructure to use it, give people time to change their behaviour, we will get there. We've seen it happen around the world. We see more and more people using it. I know that people love to say, I drive down that road, I never see someone riding their bike. I think that's just usually a null and void argument. I know that when you stand at a bike lane for long enough, you're plenty of people using it, and it may just be the commute time that people are traveling along them. But I'd also, my counter argument would be that behavior change takes a lot longer than just changing your route. So like, unlike when you put a new route in for a car and you just decide, I'll take a right here and head down that new piece of road, behavior change is actually getting people out of the cars and onto the bikes. So the measurement of success for a bit of bike infrastructure is day one is years down the track. And I think it would be a 10-year measurement of success, not a 12-month measurement of success.
Coming back to your first fear regarding we are not adapting to pedestrian behaviors or pedestrian safety. Obviously, the very pessimistic futurists would say that, all right, so we are talking about walls, which would keep pedestrians crossing the roads just in specific times or specific spaces, and that would keep them very safe. How can we create a safe environment for pedestrians without creating, for example, designs which are not permitting people to do some stuff?
Well, I guess it speaks to that point of speed by design, rather. If you're creating an environment that is conducive to vehicle movements, but those vehicle movements are slower. So obviously we've got freeways for a reason, highways for a reason, and they are for the most part all about vehicles, and that's fine. If we need cars going at 80 to 100 kilometres in those spaces, wonderful. But for the most part, that road out the front of your house is there for the community. So when your house finishes until the opposite side of the street where the next house starts, that whole width of space is for transport, well, transport and public realm space. So if we reimagine that space so that we can accommodate slower vehicle movements while still allowing it, but if we put the design in to encourage that slow movement so that people are driving on feel, not based on the sign, because if you go and put a 40-kilometre sign up or a 30-kilometre sign up, it really doesn't mean much if it feels like that road should be 60 kilometres, because you'll turn the corner, you'll see the sign speed, you'll drive for 10, 20 seconds, and then a minute down the road, you'll be doing 60K because that's how the road feels like you should be driving. And so in order to change that space, it's a lot easier in greenfield areas where you reduce the width of the road, you put in certain treatments to slow a car down around a roundabout or a chicane or a brief little stretch where it's only one way for 10 metres just so that cars have to stop and give way. But retrofitting existing areas is probably a urban designer's best dream, but at the same time, the reality of getting it into practice is really quite challenging. And so it does come at a cost in order to shrink a road, to put treatment in so that it might not be a through road anymore. You could have a through for bikes and through for pedestrians, but at a certain point, because it's only servicing houses, that you just have to enter your end of the street from a different end in order to slow vehicles down so that it's safe for everyone, but still maintaining those access that the people are used to and accustomed to.
You also mentioned that people's resistance to change can be quite challenging and can be stated that I never see a people biking in those bike lanes because behavior change takes much longer time. But how can we investigate those results without creating a very bad bike lane because it's not on the right spot? It will never be used. And we will just say that, oh, behavior changes take so much more time instead of, well, this is not the right place for the bike lane. So what is the difference between a false positive idea and a real positive idea, for example, in a case of a bike lane?
When it comes to bike infrastructure, I guess there's some really good tools that we can use from a technology point of view, whether it's data capture, as in on-road data capture, putting up sensors or putting down sensors in order to capture what's already occurring there. The counter argument to that might be that the bikes aren't there because the road isn't ready for it. But if the bikes are there, obviously we've already ticked that first space because there's obviously a desire to head that way. The other approach would be using data that we can get off people's, their phones pinging or off Strava data. Strava data is, while that might be a little bit of a different style of use, there are a lot more people these days that do use their commute and put it on Strava. So they might only be riding 4 or 5 kilometers to the office, but people love to log that data. So that's a really probably entry-level type of space to get into. But I think when it comes to community engagement and around integrated transport strategies, they're probably two of the bigger tools about, we've picked a general 4 or 5 street block of, we need bikes to head north, south or east, west down this part of the city. Through community engagement, I think we can get decide on a little bit more of an appropriate through that space. Again, someone's always going to be upset with where something goes or not support something for whatever reason. But community engagement is key when it comes to transport projects, how any project when it comes to urban development. But I think essentially the community engagement is probably the most important, and we need to back that with data. So if we've got trials, we can put things in as a trial treatment. It doesn't necessarily have to be an ultimate design when we start things off. Plenty of examples of that right around Victoria. Melbourne's done a really good job of putting down trial bollards to eventually then put them in as permanent infrastructure. If we're collecting the data before that goes in and when that goes in, we can then measure the success over time. Again, back to my previous point, I think we need a decent measure of time to see what sort of behavior change we are seeing. And coupled with that, we probably do need to do a lot of advertising, if you will, around what's going in, because it's all well and good to put down a really good bike lane somewhere. But if you don't know about it, because not everyone follows the City of Melbourne's Instagram account, for example. So you need to engage with the community so that people know that infrastructure is there. And we've got lots of great active travel lobbyists like the Bicycle Network Victoria. They're great at pushing all those messages as well. But again, it's to like-minded people. So whether it comes down to signs around town or community pop-up events to promote these things, and then with all that data, we can hopefully build a really strong business case for the next example, so that when local government members, be them councillors or on a state-owned road, lobbies, they can see where things are working and see what success has occurred so that they feel less concerned when the next project pops up.
It's reassuring to hear that these changes don't just happen on a whim because somebody said something and then we have to do that. But you have some data, you have some community engagement, you have planning behind that. That's really reassuring.
Yeah, well, I think in my personal experience, I've always viewed data is key. So I love the idea of being able to measure not just the bike riders in a space, but the whole road user. So if we're from a truck down to a pedestrian, so that you can really tell the story of this is what we're seeing in terms of increased use of private vehicles or increased use in truck movements. And that might correlate with why we're seeing less pedestrians, or we've seen a decrease in truck movements, which might go the other way. We're seeing more bikes and pedestrians in this space. But I think that sort of data has become much more affordable and a lot more accessible in recent times. And I think that'll be something that'll become a lot more common in order to support business cases and general stories so the public can have access to all the data as well and see where something is and why it's there.
How do you differentiate between the data driving the decisions and the data informing the decisions? For example, talking about the predict and provide approach, where from historical data, we establish more roads because there are more cars on the roads, but maybe that's not the best sustainable idea. First and foremost, do you differentiate between data informing or predicting the decisions?
I guess in terms of data informing decisions, I think from in a greenfield space, that's a huge part of what occurs. So we do a lot of analysis of the traffic movements through various computer programs that are predicting the vehicle movements through a intersection and through various streets, like where cars are going to be distributed based on yet to be constructed neighborhood activity centers, where there might be shops, where the schools are going to go based on the population that will be at those schools, be that primary or a high school, the housing distribution and the density that goes into those things. So in terms of planning for greenfield spaces where we're putting in a brand new road network and a brand new estate of various sizes, the data is really at the forefront. So that's something that gets asked about often when we change things. So a project that I'm working on at the moment, we've removed a number of intersections from a new structure plan because the cost of what's going in has really gone through the roof. And so all those ideas of nice to haves have gone back to the drawing board and been assessed on, will this network operate efficiently if we pull out the following intersections in order to bring down the costs? Obviously, it has trickle-on effects on the road design, how much land is being used in order to put in the road network, which if it's reduced, that means you might actually be able to build more houses, which can be a good thing from a developer's point of view. But yeah, data is at the forefront when it comes to greenfield developments, absolutely. And then when it comes to existing areas, it is a little bit of a different sort of approach in that you're probably using historical data over time. So if you're seeing an upswing in particular movements, so there's definitely an element of like this space wouldn't be appropriate to put in a new bike route because the density is not high enough, or it would be a longer route in order to get somewhere and wouldn't be appropriate. Whereas when it comes to the greenfield argument, it's a lot more of a clean slate. So you can draw straight lines in a much easier way as opposed to retrofitting our spaces for better bike and pedestrian movements.
What does retrofitting mean to you? I had Ted Bilyeu talk about retrofitting from a very strategic, very high level point of view. What does retrofitting mean to you?
Put simply, retrofitting is going into an area that's already established. Obviously, my lens is I'm concentrating on transport. So there's an existing street with buildings of various sizes, and you're reimagining that space in order for it to achieve something different. That space would have to go in and move the car parks in closer to each other. So you've reduced the width of the road. You've put in, be that an increased pedestrian path and an increase of greenery, or you've put in bike lanes, protected bike lanes between the cars and the curb instead of on the other side of the vehicles where they're more vulnerable. Yeah, retrofitting to me is going into a space that's already established and changing how that space is built and how it ultimately is used when you're finished with the project.
Then what are the three biggest opportunities regarding the future of cities for you?
The three biggest opportunities, in generally speaking, for cities would be we do need to change the way that we live. So our density is a huge problem, really, I guess, in Australia. We're a very small nation on a huge landmass, and we've essentially allowed ourselves to keep chasing the quarter-acre suburban block. And while that may be appropriate in certain regional places, it certainly, in my opinion, we've long ago left that behind in places like Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane. And that might not be a popular decision, but I think if you're moving to a local council area that's 70, 80 kilometres from Melbourne and having to drive over an hour to get there, to me, that's getting to the point where perhaps you're compromising your style of living in order to live within four walls. So I think an opportunity would be we need to work on infill development, appropriate infill development in existing suburbs, and how we can bring the community along on those journeys with us. So by enabling better density along transit corridors, be that a train line or a tram line or a well-serviced bus line, we can then better service the city and better service the locals and ultimately provide them with a better quality of life because they can get where they need to go sooner and in a more enjoyable way than if we just let the world run in the same motion that it's going at the moment. That's a huge opportunity, which then probably does lead on to how we can then deliver service upgrades. So if we've got what's coming first, is it the horse before the cart or the cart before the horse? If we've increased the density in certain spots, the state government's going to be a lot more keen to put in extra rail services, extra tram services, extra bus services. Buses are a huge tool that perhaps we're not very good at harnessing in Victoria. So the more we can bring people on a journey to discover how great the buses are, the better. But if we're increasing the frequency, they're servicing more spaces, then people are naturally going to jump into that space. The third one, which I've harped on a little bit, is active travel to me is key. If we're living closer to where we go to dine, where we go to work, where we go to socialize, where we go to be educated, then that's going to make life a lot more simple. I'm reluctant to use terms like the 15-minute city, but that sort of network is something that I think is key for the future. So the idea that we can live in a little bit more of a village setting that enables us to move into the city when we need to, stay close to home when we need to, and have resources near us is one that I think is a very practical approach. Personally, I think it's an appealing thing. It might not be everyone's first swipe at how they want to live, but I think in the way that Australia's population is going and the population growth, that those things are getting into they should be less optional. It should be more of a necessity moving forward.
Why are you reluctant to use the 15-minute city term?
Well, I think just recently there's been a little bit of backlash from people, perhaps either misunderstanding what a 15-minute city actually means, or running with an aspect of what a 15-minute city is and embellishing on that a little bit. I know that some of my colleagues and at my current workplace and a couple of other places have mentioned the sort of backlash that they've received by mentioning terms such as a 15-minute city or 20-minute neighbourhood or smart city and all the things that come with smart technology. And I think the backlash that we've seen across the world, but in Australia, just with regards to that term, in my opinion, is a little bit ridiculous. I think that the 15-minute city itself is a fantastic model in terms of building your community around a resource so that you're close to it. So whether you're close to the healthcare, close to your school, your children's school, close to a place of employment, close to the place of recreation, I think it's hard to argue with that being a bad thing. If you can walk to your children's school with your child, that sounds great to me. And I think that's something that many of us can already do, but a lot of us don't live in suburbs that are built like that. So yeah, the 15-minute city is a fantastic sort of model that we have been trying to adapt, particularly in our greenfield developments, something that would take a long time to actually become a reality, the way that a new development would be built. But in terms of our existing areas, a lot of us are already living in those spaces. So to have that sort of pushback on something that isn't a new concept is a little bit of an interesting argument. I would argue that if you're living in Carlton, Fitzroy, Footscray, St Kilda, Albert Park, Middle Park, all the way down to Brighton, like you're living in a 15-minute city, a 15-minute suburb, you can get to the doctors, you can get to a school, you can get to public transport, you can get to a cafe and a lot more things easily in that amount of time. And there's probably a reason why the property prices reflect that in those areas.
What are the services for you? You mentioned deliver service upgrades as an opportunity. What are these services you are talking about?
I'm talking about transport services. So I'm fortunate enough to live in an area where during the week there's a 10-minute bus frequency that runs very close to my house. But I know that for the most of Melbourne, those bus services are significantly less. Like we're talking, it's pretty good if you're hitting 20 minutes. It's pretty normal if you're hitting 40 minutes. There's plenty of bus services that are coming every 2 hours. And that sort of service upgrade is something that if you're adding an extra service every hour, that very quickly becomes a lot more attractive mode of transport. So the bus one is a huge area for service upgrades. The train one, we'll likely see large upgrades in the future as a result of the Melbourne Metro 1 tunnel being completed. We'll likely see some better train services. And for the most part, depending on where you live, train services in Melbourne are pretty good at this stage. But yeah, the bus service upgrade is something that there's a huge room for improvement. There's probably a few other things that I personally would like to see when it comes to buses. So things like real-time tracking data needs to be commonplace, needs to be every bus should have some sort of GPS beacon on it so that we know how far a bus is away. I know personally that you can't really trust when you jump online, it says the bus is 6 minutes away. Often that's not the case. So if we can upgrade that technology along the way, I think those service upgrades that we can deliver are going to change people's behaviours and change the way we can get around the place.
And do you also include service upgrades for the active transport?
From a service perspective, I think the way that I speak about services would probably be the movements themselves, but I guess that probably then takes us into a different sort of area where we've seen the arrival of e-bikes and e-scooters on our streets in many local government areas around Victoria. And for the most part, they're doing really well. So the scooters are having a huge amount of people are jumping on scooters every day and a significant amount of people are jumping on the e-bikes. So that service that has been provided, which we refer to as mobility as a service, is really something that has evolved really quickly in a local context. So I know the first iteration of the Lime bikes, which was called Jump, started just as COVID hit. And so it was paused pretty much straight away and then re-entered later in 2020. And it has been coming along in various leaps and bounds since that stage. But to be talking about a program that's not really 3 years old yet, given that it restarted in December, I think it was in 2020. And now it's become commonplace in the local government areas that do have it. That sort of shows the strength of how behavior change can occur really quickly and that we probably measure things in probably too short an amount of time. And then when you look at the scooter aspect, I know the scooters have done numbers that far outstrip the e-bikes. We've had media around some of the issues that have occurred with e-scooters, but for the most part, those scooters are doing a really good job of getting people on that last mile trip from a public service location to home or to a restaurant, or as their days evolve, they're just using it to get from point A to point B when perhaps they didn't have the option previously at a reasonably cheap price in order to do. And I think as time evolves, we're going to see more providers in that space, but we'll likely see more services as well. 10 years ago, if you said there was going to be an e-scooter phase in Melbourne, you would have thought that that sounds ridiculous. Maybe e-bikes may have sounded a little bit more feasible 10 years ago, but who knows what we're going to see in the future, that what services will come into the space to provide people transport options.
Do you have an opinion on why the e-scooters are more popular than the e-bikes?
I think people view them as it's a lot easier to use, essentially. I guess there's probably an argument for them being, how active is an e-scooter? You're not actually using any much physical exertion in order to propel an e-scooter, but I personally think that they're a great device. It's certainly better than someone jumping in a car to make a small trip. But in having had conversations with some of the providers, they don't see a huge overlap in users. So while some people think that it's just going to be, I'll ride a scooter, or I'll ride a bike, some people are very much stuck in a pool of, I only ride bikes, I only ride scooters. And so if we've increased the pool of users that are going to be using these e-mobility services, I think the introduction of a scooter is a really useful tool. And anecdotally, I have heard that there's a lot more females ride scooters than the e-bikes. I haven't read too much into that information, but yeah, that's the information that I've seen.
And then what are the three biggest strengths regarding the future of cities for you?
I think one of the biggest strengths that we have at the moment is that there are a lot more people that are trying to rattle the cages for change. As much as we're not going to get where I think we should be in the time that I think we should get there, I think that we're seeing a lot more people that are pushing for change. And as that is normalized, I think we're just going to see an uplift in understanding of how we can use our spaces. So I think from a personal point of view, I think that's really exciting to think that my nieces and nephews, for example, could be living in a very different Australia than what I grew up in. And I think that's fantastic. So if you're a 10-year-old, 11-year-old girl who is used to seeing all these things occurring around you, so the whole idea of increased density around shopping centres and around shopping strips is normalised. People riding bikes along protected bike lanes is normalised. Seeing major projects around putting a suburban rail loop in or building the Melbourne Metro tunnel, those things weren't happening when I was a kid. I couldn't point to any major bit of infrastructure that was being built around public transport. So while we did see some, you know, rail lines extended, that's such a local issue, really. If you're living on the outskirts of Melbourne and they add another kilometre of rail in, I don't really think that's a huge newsworthy story. Whereas when we're spending our money on tunnelling for a train as opposed to tunnelling for cars, I think that's sending a stronger, more hopeful message to the future generations. So I think that's a huge opportunity and a huge area of growth that we're seeing in Melbourne. And I think another strength would be that, again, maybe from a personal point of view, is that in Australia, we're seeing some cities do some amazing things. So hopefully, if the likes of Sydney and Brisbane are going through a transformation, that is then spurring that competitive nature of places like Melbourne in order to keep up with what's happening in these other places. The leveraging off the Brisbane 2032 Olympics is going to be a really huge asset for Brisbane. And hopefully some of the things that place is doing means that Sydney and Melbourne want to keep up with what's occurring in that area as well.
Regarding the Olympics, are the Olympics a good investment in infrastructure?
Look, major events is a complicated issue. Like obviously we've seen recently Victoria 2026 fold and isn't going to take place. And then the follow-up Commonwealth Games in Canada have done the same thing. But from an Olympic perspective, I think Australia is in a bit of a different position than some other countries. I think it's very much a case-by-case basis. So it stems around not building a big white elephant, essentially, where if we're building infrastructure that people are going to use in legacy mode, then yes, it obviously comes with a large cost to deliver things in the short term. But you can see the improvements that Brisbane is trying to do from a transport perspective around the Olympics. And so they've got the horizon of a 12-year run-up and when they won the bid. And so they've got 12 years to improve their infrastructure in order to facilitate a two-week event. But the reality is that the livability of that city is going through the roof in the meantime, and out the other side, it will be a city that's much more known on a global scale, but also their infrastructure is of a much more of a modern day approach. And I guess because Brisbane is, it's a city that was built around the car, it's a city that was built, its major growth occurred post 1950, whereas having an event like this is going to do so much for it, it might not be appropriate for certain cities around the world where we have seen major stadiums that get left behind. We have seen rail that was perhaps built around the approach from a getting spectators to the event, as opposed to that's a nice byproduct of building a better rail network to get our people to and from where they need to be.
Again, that's very reassuring that you think that these developments will be not just for the Olympics, but also for Brisbane's future. That's really good.
So previously, I've actually worked on the Commonwealth Games at the Gold Coast. And so there was some really good infrastructure put in place that was based around the community to the point where the infrastructure was ready too early. And so the community was using it before the games started, which meant that it had to be taken off the community in order to run the event. But that's a good thing in that the community demand was there when they'd put in the infrastructure. And so that as soon as that event had disappeared, these gymnastics facilities, these netball courts, these basketball courts, these training facilities for the professional football team were all ready to go and be used. So while there are aspects of a swimming facility where they did have temporary stands put in and they made the athletics facility a little bit bigger, it wasn't a big piece of infrastructure that was only built around 2 years. They had built great community assets for the community that were delivered at a really high standard, right down to having more fancy doorknobs and push buttons on the toilets that they wouldn't have got if it wasn't for those events. And then that's coupled with upgrades to their motorway and putting in the G-Link tram service connection that they needed to get from the rail into the city. And then how that's at the moment playing out, where they're looking at the next phase of that tram delivery, which is a massive asset for the city that, in my opinion, wouldn't have been occurring and at the very least wouldn't have occurred at the same rate if it wasn't for the Gold Coast having the Commonwealth Games.
Just for the audience, what is the difference between Olympic Games and the Commonwealth Games?
The Olympic Games is every country in the world, whereas the Commonwealth Games stems around countries that are or were part of the British Empire. They used to be called the Empire Games and became the Commonwealth Games. So there's a bit of an interesting background in that space. But yeah, it's a legacy that's rolled over into more of a competitive sporting space.
Oliver, you have been very generous with your time. What is your role in establishing the future of cities?
My role is a planning and advocacy role. In the strategic transport space, we're looking at long-term planning in order to deliver a better outcome for places that don't exist, but also places that are currently operating. So with my team, we're looking at developing integrated transport strategies. We're looking at using approaches that are different to how we are currently doing things so that there's a little bit breaking the mold in order to achieve a different outcome, because I'm a firm subscriber to that motto. If we keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result, that's a definition of crazy. We need to do things differently in order to get to a more sustainable approach to our transport network.
Thank you so much again for your time, Oliver. It was really interesting to hear your transport planning approach and how you want to do these different things. That's just amazing. So thank you so much for your work as well. Do you have any closing comments or requests for the audience?
Yeah, I think you need to jump on your bike, make sure you ride to the shops, and you need to send more letters to your local state member. So you need to get onto your state member for things that you want to see changing. Hassle your local council for things that belong in their space, and hassle your local state member for change. If you're not rattling the cages for change, then who is?
Oliver, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
It was really interesting to hear from Oliver's description for changing how we live as an opportunity, not to mention his understanding for urban retrofit. Ted Bellew talked about a different urban retrofit aspect in episode 182. You can find out more about Oliver online. All the links are in the show notes. What was the most interesting part for you? What questions did arise regarding Oliver's approach to the future of cities? What have you learned from this interview? Let me know on Twitter at WTF4Cities or on the WTF4Cities.com website, where the transcripts and show notes are available. You can also subscribe on the website not to miss any new episodes and leave some feedback. I hope this was an interesting interview for you as well, and thanks for tuning in.
What is the Future for Cities podcast?